Ernie Klein can't get the 80s out of his head. So instead of kicking his 80s habit to the curb, he's embraced it and written a novel built around the time. It's called Ready Player One. The plot involves an eccentric billionaire named James Halliday, who's invented the ultimate virtual reality world, a massively multiplayer online game called Oasis. When he dies, Halliday leaves a hidden clue embedded deep within the game. Whoever finds it is heir to his fortune and fame. What will it take to win? Total immersion in the 1980s world of pop culture. Here's a reading from the book, performed by Will Wheaton.
Everyone my age remembers where they were and what they were doing when they first heard about the contest. I was sitting in my hideout watching cartoons when the news bulletin broke in on my video feed, announcing that James Halliday had died during the night. I'd heard of Halliday, of course. Everyone had. He was the video game designer responsible for creating the Oasis, a massively multiplayer online game that had gradually evolved into the globally networked virtual reality most of humanity now used on a daily basis. The unprecedented success of the Oasis had made Halliday one of the wealthiest people in the world. At first, I couldn't understand why the media was making such a big deal of the billionaire's death. After all, the people of planet Earth had other concerns. The ongoing energy crisis, catastrophic climate change, widespread famine, poverty and disease, half a dozen wars, you know, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria. Normally, the news feeds didn't interrupt everyone's interactive sitcoms and soap operas unless something really major had happened, like the outbreak of some new killer virus or another major city vanishing in a mushroom cloud. Big stuff like that. As famous as he was, Halliday's death should have warranted only a brief segment on the evening news so the unwashed masses could shake their heads in envy when the newscasters announced the obscenely large amount of money that would be doled out to the rich man's heirs. But that was the rub. James Halliday had no heirs.
A reading from the audiobook of Ready Player One, as performed by Will Wheaton. Novelist Ernest Klein told Anne Strangechamps why the 80s pop culture that fills his novel is so compelling to him.
Definitely, I think as far as movies and the entertainment of the 1980s, I think it was kind of a golden age, especially for movies. Like those movies that came out in the 80s made me want to become a filmmaker and a writer and just have inspired me my whole life. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to celebrate it. I also think it was kind of a unique time in that it was kind of the birth of the computer era. We were, my generation, we were the first kids to have a home video game console, like a video game in our house, and and also the first generation to have a home computer, that we would do our homework on. I was very quick to embrace it. And I feel like, kind of the dawn of the internet age all began, and the home computer age all began in the 70s and 80s. So that's one of the reasons I'm fascinated by it.
We should paint a bit of a picture here for those of us who are, either too old or maybe too young to remember that world as intimately as you do. What are some of the main touchstones? Take music, for instance.
Of the 80s, I was kind of, back then I was obsessed with the band Rush, which ends up playing a big role in my book. But Rush was kind of like the quintessential rock and roll band for the isolated, outcast, brooding, nerdy teenager, which is what I was. Their lyrics are all about isolation and the individual, and they have big, theatrical, like science fiction space operas and, just really smart lyrics. And I loved the band Rush so much that I paid tribute to them in my first movie that I wrote, Fanboys, as well. There's a character in that film that's obsessed with Rush.
And what about movies?
Movies? That was another kind of innovation, I think, something new that my generation had that happened in the 80s, late 70s and the 80s, was the advent of home video. We were the first generation to have access to this kind of giant library of movies, whereas previous generations, if you didn't see it in the theater or, catch it later on TV, you didn't get to see it, whereas once my family got a VHS player, I could, watch this giant library of movies and watch the movies over and over again. And I was, I kind of became a cinephile early on. And the big formative movies for me were the Star Wars movies, obviously, rocked my whole world. And the Back to the Future films I just adored, and the Indiana Jones movies, but also movies like War Games and Real Genius and Better Off Dead. There were all these great comedies and great, you know, thrillers. And
well, so let's talk about the plot of your book, Ready Player One. At the center is this kid, Wade Watts, and a game that, in fact, the entire world is obsessed with.
I wanted to pay tribute to the Roald Dahl stories that I really loved. Roald Dahl was one of my favorite writers growing up, and I love the Willy Wonka books, and I also loved James and the Giant Peach, kind of these stories about downtrodden kids in kind of rough circumstances who would something would happen in their life, you know, like the Golden Ticket Contest or, you know, what happened with James and the Giant Peach. You know, something fantastic would happen and take them off on a out of their, you know, horrible circumstances on some fantastic adventure. And I always wanted to tell a story like that. And I also love stories about eccentric billionaires who, you know, hold a contest. Like there are several movies that I loved as a kid that played on that theme, like Scavenger Hunt and It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World. And of course, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And there was another movie called Brewster's Millions also that had a kind of an eccentric billionaire holding a strange contest. So I love, you know, I love Roald Dahl and I love that idea.
So I'm betraying my video game ignorance, but in the book you call this an Easter egg. I guess this is a common term in video games?
It is. Yeah. And, you know, it's inspired by, you know, real Easter eggs. The idea is that an Easter egg is something in a video game, and they're also on DVDs, and, you know, some people would even say Beatles albums, you know, have Easter eggs, like those, you know, those messages hidden on Beatles albums if you play them backwards in certain, you know, which I don't know if those actually exist, but
I don't know. I tried that. I never heard anything.
I never did either. It sounded pretty thin to me, but that was actually where the video game designer who created the very first Easter egg got the idea for his Easter egg was from a Beatles album. A man who worked for Atari and made games for the Atari 2600 back in the 70s named Warren Robinette. Back then, Atari didn't give their video game designers credit for their work, so the person who created a video game, their name didn't appear anywhere on the package or anywhere in the game itself, and that was really frustrating for him. So he created a secret room inside his adventure game with a secret key, and if you found this secret key, you could go into this room, and his name was hidden there. And Atari didn't know that he had done this, and they made thousands of copies of the game and shipped it all over the world, and they didn't find out, you know, that Robinette had hidden his name inside the game until kids all over the world started to find it and, you know, send in letters describing how they had found it. And I was one of those kids that found it. And I, you know, I've, you know, since met a lot of other people who found it. And there was something really incredibly exciting about that, like the secret that had been left there by the original video game designer that no one else knew about. And he, you know, he left it there for me to find. And when I did, I felt this connection with the video game designer. So that idea that stuck with me, and that idea, you know, played a big role in my book. That's kind of the inspiration for the eccentric billionaires contest in Ready Player One. He's hidden this secret room somewhere inside this giant sprawling virtual reality, and whatever kid finds it, you know, will inherit his fortune and control of his company, and therefore control of the whole virtual world itself. So it's, you know, kind of the biggest lottery ticket imaginable. And since all of the puzzles and riddles that have to be unlocked to win this huge fortune deal with, you know, the pop culture of this billionaire's childhood, you know, he's made all the puzzles and riddles deal with stuff that he's obsessed with. And that's the stuff of, you know, of his childhood, of this 1970s and 80s and classic video games and John Hughes movies and bands like Rush and Duran Duran that he used to love. So you have all these kids in the future who end up becoming obsessed with the past and studying the past so they can unlock these, so they can unlock these riddles. And that's the general gist of Ready Player One.
That's interesting, because I'm thinking about what earlier generations might say about the common culture that unifies their generation. You know, for instance, kids whose formative years were more the 60s or early 70s, the unifying thing that brought them together could very well have been politics, the anti-war movement, maybe the first countercultural music. So that had a kind of political edge to it. Does it bother you that you're saying that what unifies your generation is a popular culture that was created by corporations?
Well, yeah, and I think that's definitely the case, you know, created by, you know, not just corporations, but also musicians and filmmakers and, you know, really talented filmmakers like John Hughes. You know, like, he is arguably the most influential filmmaker of my childhood, and his movies, you know, had a really deep, like, resonating effect with a huge cross-section of my generation. And I think part of that, and I don't think it's completely void of political, I mean, I think the one big political factor of the 80s and that kind of is the shadow that hangs over all of, you know, late 70s and 1980s culture is the Cold War. And I think one of the reasons my generation is maybe so fixated or fascinated with the pop culture and the cartoons and, you know, kind of all of the totems of our childhood is during that whole decade, we, you know, from the time we were little kids, we were kind of warned that the world could end at any moment. We all grew up in the shadow of these two superpowers kind of teetering on the brink of collapse. There was no subtlety about it. I remember watching like the made-for-TV movie The Day After that was directed by Nicholas Meyer, which was kind of this big television event. And it was really, you know, I had nightmares for months afterwards as a result of, you know, just this fear of World War III happening at any time. So, I mean, none of that overtly political stuff is in my book, but I feel like the Cold War and that kind of sense of impending dread or worry about the end of the world maybe is one of the reasons that my generation has this accelerated nostalgia and is kind of so attached to the totems of their youth is because they were so important to us and such an important distraction from this, you know, cynical teetering on the brink of apocalypse worldview. But, you know, that's just a theory.
Ernest Cline is a screenwriter and the author of Ready Player One. He talked with Anstrain Champs.